I'm Chris Sharon, and together with my wife Sonia, I'm helping to coordinate the teaching staff and other things that fit into the programmatic life of the village this summer. And occasionally, great opportunities come along for conversations that are important to our life together in the church. And one of those led to tonight's conversation. Ann Niederinghaus and I talked about the fact that she serves on the ELCA Church Council, which is the body, the smaller body that makes decisions for the ELCA in between gatherings of the Churchwide Assembly, which is the official legislative body. And so we said, well, let's have a night when people can come and just ask questions and hear a little bit about what's going on in the ELCA at the churchwide level. And then we realized that Christine Carlson was here, and she serves on the churchwide, you've just been elected to a churchwide committee, the Evangelical Outreach and Congregational Mission Committee for the churchwide. So we invited her to be a part of the conversation too. Not necessarily for them to say a lot, but to say a little and then to listen to a variety of comments and questions and issues that you all have in mind, because that will inform their leadership on behalf of all of us. And then, after we came up with this just wonderful idea, we realized that the Lutheran this month has this question on their cover. Connections up and down the church. If we're connected at all levels of the ELCA, if not, why not, and what can we do? So people, they argue, think of a local congregation when they hear church. But in the ELCA, we talk about three levels of church, the local congregation, the synodical expression, and then the churchwide. And lots of the ministry that we do goes out from our churchwide offices and leadership. So that's what tonight's about, and each of the two of them, Christine and Anne, are going to say a little bit to start off the conversation, and then we'll invite all of you to jump in.
I guess I'm going to start. I'm Ann Niederinghaus from Duluth, Minnesota, and I guess I wanted to start with maybe asking a few questions. How many of you have had leadership, volunteer leadership positions in your congregation, ELCA or not? How about at the synod level? How many have done volunteer leadership at the synod level? Okay, and how many at churchwide level?
Well, it, does that include women in the ELCA?
Yeah. And so your position here with Ann?
I have in the past been on the churchwide board for women of the ELCA.
And for you? Currently the intern at Christine's church.
And did Dan put your hand up too?
Yeah, I was on the, forgot the name of it, the Peace
Task Force.
Peace Task Force.
Course.
For
at the church.
Year and a half.
Well, it's almost 3 years ago that I got a phone call in February, or no, it is 3 years ago in February that I got a call from the assistant bishop, or the bishop's assistant for Northeastern Minnesota, asking if I'd be willing to fill out this application to be considered, to be looked at for nomination for the ELCA Church Council. And if it hadn't been short, I probably wouldn't have even done it because we were going to leave that day on a vacation, but it was very short, so I did it. And at that time, my involvement was really pretty strictly at the congregational level. I'd been chair of a call committee, chair of some committees, and president of my congregation. And the most I had even done at the synod level was to be a voting member at the synod assembly. And so it was sort of a surprise. And most of my governance and administrative experience had been more in nonprofits, including LSS Minnesota and here at Holden. And so it was, and then it was in 2005 at the Churchwide Assembly that I was elected to serve a six-year, it's a six-year term, non-renewable for the church council. And I'm nearing now unbelievably the halfway point already. It goes by very quickly. And I can say it's been so far a privilege and a marvelous learning experience. And I think things like this are exactly why it is. Because part of what we're supposed to do is go to be newly, one of the things that was suggested for church council members is that we be linked to two synods that we keep in touch with. And so that, and this is kind of like that. I think it's an opportunity to talk to people and hear from you, your concerns, your questions, your advice, you know, whatever it is. I'll just say briefly a little about church council. Many of you, I think, probably know about it, but the ELCA church council is made up of the officers of the church and 33 elected members from specific synods now since it's been reworked. I was elected as a lay female from Northeastern Minnesota Synod. In addition to the 33 members, there are 20 advisors. Some of this is new because there was the reshuffling of how things are set up. These are speaking, not voting members. And we can talk more about who those, I think, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail because people can maybe ask if they want that kind of detail, statistics, structure, what's coming up. I think we more want to talk about what you want to talk about. But our responsibility is to be, and these are the exact words, I think, interim legislative authority between churchwide assemblies, which means that we make initial recommendations about issues which are, we address issues forwarded to us by the churchwide assembly, by synod assemblies, by ELCA leadership, and we make initial recommendations about these issues which are to be brought to churchwide assembly for final decisions. And so that is what our duty is. So it seems like about, I've gone through about one round where you see both halves. You know, maybe the first half of the 2 years you're sort of responding to what has come up at the churchwide, and then the next half you're sort of starting to get things ready for the next churchwide. So we really are interim authority. There's a lot of things out that I could talk about details, but actually what I think I wanted to do is read something from Bonhoeffer's Life Together, because this is something that I've, and this is one of many pieces from this that have been important to me both in my work at my congregation here at Holden and now at ELCA Churchwide, which in fact is church community writ large, I think. So I'll just, it was hard to pick which one, but I'll pick one and I'm gonna sort of make the language a little more inclusive than it is. But this is from Life Together by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. One is a brother or sister to another only through Jesus Christ. I am a brother or sister to another person through what Jesus Christ did for me and to me. The other person has become a brother or sister to me through what Jesus Christ did for him or her. This fact that we are brethren or sisters only through Jesus Christ is of immeasurable significance. Not only the other person who is earnest and devout, who comes to me seeking community, must I deal with in fellowship. My brother or sister is rather that other person who has been redeemed by Christ, delivered from sin and called to faith and eternal life. Not what one is in oneself as a Christian, one's spirituality and piety constitutes the basis of our community. What determines our community is what that one is by reason of Christ. Our community with one another consists solely in what Christ has done to both of us. This is true not merely at the beginning, as though in the course of time something else were to be added to our community. It remains so for all the future and to all eternity. I have community, and I would say no matter on what size, with others, and I shall continue to have it only through Jesus Christ. The more genuine and deeper our community becomes, the more will everything else between us recede, the more clearly and purely will Jesus Christ and his work become the one and only thing that is vital between us. We have one another only through Christ, but through Christ we do have one another wholly and for all eternity. I would claim that we are able to work in an institutional church effectively only when we start with this kind of understanding that it is not some sort of ideal community, but a human one. Held together, though, by forgiveness under God's grace, and that this is our only basis for community. And already, in just the short time I have had the privilege, I have experienced that when I can even fleetingly grasp this, then I can learn Christ from others in surprising and life-giving ways.
For my opening remarks, I'm Christine Carlson from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And Bishop Mark Hansen attended our Synod Assembly this spring and spoke a number of times. And he has an interesting image to me to talk about our church. He called it an ecology of interdependent ecosystems. An ecology of interdependent ecosystems that is seeking to tell and be the love of Christ for the world. It's an ecology of interdependent ecosystems that has a long history. And part of how we tend to see the ELCA today is shaped in part by what branch of Lutheranism we come to this ELCA body out of. I come out of a particular branch of the Norwegian American Lutheran Church. The congregation I'm serving, Christ Church Lutheran in Minneapolis, comes out of the Missouri Synod. It's a former Missouri Synod church that journeyed into AELC and then came to ELCA. We come together with some different traditions of church and pastor and lay people and structure. Or if a person comes new to the ELCA without that history, it shapes how they see church. As I reflected on this ecology of all these interdependent parts, I've been shaped by many of them myself. I grew up out east. I was born, baptized, and confirmed in the Metropolitan New York Synod. Then I came to St. Olaf College, a college of the church. I served as a pastor in our Minneapolis area synod, the synodical level. I've served also in southeastern Minnesota and in eastern North Dakota. So those are other parts of this ecology. I attended a seminary of the church. I'm a granddaughter of missionaries to Madagascar, so the global mission enterprise has affected me. I attended Camp Koinonia in upstate New York when I was a girl and have come to Holden Village almost every year since I don't know when. Those are other parts of this ecology. I've written Bible studies and articles for women of the ELCA. I'm grateful for the work of the Lutheran World Relief, for Lutheran Social Service in Minnesota, which now has a goal of no child in poverty, and we're being invited into that effort, for instance. I'm now a member of this church-wide committee, whose name I'm still trying to learn. I'm interested that Dan Erlander couldn't remember quite the name of the committee you belong to. You know, Evangelical Outreach and Congregational Mission. Unpack that one. And I also was just elected a voting member to the next churchwide assembly, so involved at that level too. There are many things we could talk about tonight about the ELCA, but I want to talk about a big picture thing, a big shift that I see in the metaphor that's being used now, that I notice being used for church. The church I grew up in talked a lot about membership, and I think the church was viewed as an institution, even sometimes as a club, like I belong to Rotary, I belong to my church, I belong to, I'm a scout leader for my kids. It's kind of, it was sometimes, and I'm, you know, making a stereotypical, I'm stereotyping something with that remark, but that was a bit of the sense of church. What I hear now and experience at many levels is the emergence of a new metaphor, that we are not members any so much as we are missionaries. And it's interesting to me as a granddaughter of missionaries that now I, this metaphor of mission and missionary is becoming so much part of the parlance of people at the local synod and church-wide levels. At least I'm certainly hearing that. I think the church structure is tipping then, as I hear leaders talking, to empower missional passion in congregations and in people who are part of those congregations. At the seminary, there's much talk about training pastors for missional leadership. I never heard that phrase when I was a student at the seminary. I attended Luther Seminary. We were being trained much more to tend, care for a flock, to be a chaplain, to, you know, run a church. Well, those were some of the things that my classes taught me, to teach and preach and then do those things. And now missional leadership is very much in the language of our seminaries also. And I think in ways that's an effort to claim the evangelical part of our name, and to live that out in our structures as well as in our congregation, in our lives as Christians. There's a new director of the committee that I'm part of, the Evangelical Outreach and Congregational Mission Committee. The former bishop of the Metropolitan New York Synod, the synod I grew up in, Steve Bowman, who has just moved from New York City to Chicago to begin leading this part, this arm of the church-wide. And he is engaging in a very aggressive study of what kind of church structure will enable missionaries, will enable missional leadership, and will enable congregations to be mission outposts. And that's the kind of language that when I've attended one community meeting so far in Chicago, but that was the kind of language that was very much informing our gathering together. And one of the very interesting things that he talked about is his prayer that we experience ecstasy again as people of faith, as individuals and as congregations. He, in a Bible study on the conversion of Paul, he talked about this word ecstasis in Greek, which is used to describe the conversion of Paul and several other conversions in the New Testament. And it's a word in Greek that means to ecstasis, to get outside oneself. And he is talking at a church-wide level. It's not language I anticipated hearing at a committee meeting about ecstasy. It's quite fascinating to me. I'm an English major. I am very interested in language and how that shapes us. And it's a very different thing for me to think about myself as a member of a church and for me to think about myself as a missionary called to tell and be the love of Jesus Christ for the sake of the world. And how's that going to shape us is interesting to me. So, yeah. We're interested in why you came and what are the things you would like to talk about with the ELCA. Simon.
Yes, pretty intrigued about the metaphor of the ecology of interdependent ecosystems, because As you know, each ecosystem embraces a broad diversity of species, to put it mildly, all in a state of flux or evolution. And so if we're at the same time we're all supposed to be on a mission, we are likely, in fact, in our missions to be saying rather different things since we're very broadly different species. So how does the whole system work? Or what's the vision really behind us? I'm not being contentious, but some thought must have gone into this metaphor. And I'm simply wondering how broadly are we now going to embrace different points of view, if that's what is intended.
One thing that I think of, jumping off from what you're saying, is the degree that I'm seeing of commitment to multicultural ministry. As many of you may know, at the present time, the ELCA churchwide has essentially the same budget as it did when the church was formed, 21. So there has been cuts in many areas. I mean, it's a much more pared down. One area where it has not been cut is in multicultural outreach. Half of the new developing congregations are in, and this is what you heard too, have been in communities of color or in languages other than English. So that's just a little piece of what you were asking about, but I think there is a really strong commitment to the idea that how do we get to be a church that looks like the world around us? And we haven't made very good progress in the last 21 years. And there's exciting things happening. I think there are like 22 different African national churches, you know, that have asked, in the United States, who have asked to be part of the ELCA, which I think probably has a lot to do with the international presence of the Lutheran Church and also Lutheran Immigration Services, too. But there, so that doesn't go to the whole metaphor, but it is a little piece of it that I think is interesting.
I also would say that the background of that language, the ecology language, comes from organizational sociology and not so much from biology. And Craig Dykstra, who's the head of the religion division at the Lilly Endowment, which is the single biggest funder of religious organizations in the U.S., has been using that to talk about the ELCA as one of the most healthy denominations in the interaction of its parts as a sort of coherent proposal about how you live a version of Christianity. The colleges, the seminaries, the congregations, the synods, he thinks what we have isn't perfect, but it works together pretty well with a kind of coherence that's formative. And so I think Mark probably has picked it up from Craig and is using it in that way, which is a little bit more distanced from the complexity that you're seeing in a more biological use of those terms.
You've talked a bit about some of the aspects of membership or whatever we want to call that, but is there a cohesive plan for how we're really going to gain membership? Because that's been a very weak area of our church in the last, since the merger at any rate. Is there such a plan? I mean, I've heard a couple little snippets or pieces of it here, but that's not a total strategy by any means.
Well, I think now we both are on the same, I serve as liaison from church council to the same program committee that Christine has been on. I think one thing, there are interesting different pieces. I think that one of the things they may be looking to Steve Bowman for is a more cohesive, putting it together. Some of the pieces are the multicultural thing. Another thing is we heard last year here right at Holden from Nadia, I can't remember of the
River something.
Yeah, who is part of the Emerging Church, that the ELCA is the largest funder of what is called the Emerging Church, which we could talk about, of any of the mainline denominations. And that's of churches that are being founded in places other than traditional church buildings. But I think they really are depending on Steve, because he has had a very missional within the Metropolitan, some of you may know better than we do, within the Metropolitan New York Synod, has had a very missional attitude in development and how he has worked with groups of different sorts. So that is, I think, some of it. There's the questions of large, you know, there's support systems for the large congregations to try to get together and talk. Lots of talk about the great number of small congregations that there are. And what is the role for churchwide in working with the great number of small churches, and not one answer fits all, you know?
To follow up on that, at the National Convention in Columbus, I was sitting next to Dr. Preuss, and his concern was that evangelism was going to suffer the most. And as I view our church for 20 years, I would say that what he said was true, because we have not had any evangelism programs, we have not had the kind of outreach we had when we were individual churches, and it just seems like that thing has been kind of lost. And what are they going to be doing about it?
I think part of it is, what are we doing about it? Because I think so much of it gets down to the congregation. And
yeah, but the church used to give direction in that.
Yes,
there were programs
I
that were
agree.
Given, and now there's nothing.
Well, I
literally.
Yeah. Well, I think that they are, my sense is that they are working to develop a missiology for that will be presented soon, which it will be a plan for the ELCA. And my sense is that Steve Bowman and Bishop Hansen and other directors of areas in Chicago are working hard and fast right now on this particular project. So I think soon we'll be hearing about that.
I think this Book of Faith initiative also is another part that undergirds some of this. And I don't know how much awareness there is about the Book of Faith. When that came up at church council and before that, the statement that was made, which I think is so important, was that they said, you know, our people are learning their biblical interpretation from the media. Mm-hmm. That we, you know, it's a new time that where people, that's how they, and the average Lutheran in the pew is not trained in the way that they were before on how do you interpret the Bible. And so I think there's these different pieces, and one of the things, and it was the South Carolina Synod who asked for the Book of Faith approach to talk about Lutheran interpretation of the Bible. I think if you're going to ask your people to be missionaries, you need to equip them, and I think this is a very foundational way to start that. But I think it's going to have to be not just one thing, it's going to have to be. But I think this is an important one, the Book of Faith.
And I think it isn't just interpreting the Bible, but it's trying to get the people back to read the Bible. Lutherans read the Bible.
Mm-hmm. We just had a call process in our church, and we've seen the pastor, and I wrote a congregation of about 2,300 members, and the person we called looked at our numbers. And one of the people on our committee was the head of our evangelism committee. And he said, well, what programs, when you come to our church, what programs are you going to have that are going to bring more people, that are going to help our church grow? And she said, the first thing we have to look at is you've got 2,300 members and they're worshiping about 25%. And that may sound like a low number, but that's not that low a number. The average Lutheran church worships about 28% to 30%. And the first thing you've got to do is you've got to get that other 75% involved in the life of the church. you've got to have a discipleship in your own congregation. You're not going to get other people to come in the doors if they don't, have a sense of excitement, and if your church is being run by 15 or 20% of your members. And it really struck us. I think we're kind of programmed out. You can't go convert people to become Lutherans. You got to get them in the door, and let the church do its work. You got to bring people to Holden Village, and let Holden Village do its work. And you've got to have members who are willing to do that.
Is there a distinction made between being missional in the sense of growing a church and being missional in the sense of sharing the good news? And ideally, both would happen, but we might be living in an era where we may need to get out there and just share the good news and not necessarily expect that.
And that's what's sort of interesting about the emerging church.
Yeah.
Church, as Nadia talked about, outreach, and she's doing Theology Cafe in Denver, I think it is. If you want to look at it, she has a web page and a blog that's called, what is it?
Sarcastic
Lutheran. So I think there's this experimentation happening too about, where do you meet people? Where do you meet them? And I think that's what's exciting about some of the multicultural. It's true to try different things. Be willing to say, we will support this and see, where it goes.
Because our call is really sharing the good news.
Right. Mm-hmm. Not filling necessarily.
We
the
love
biggest
both.
Churches. Yeah.
One of the interesting distinctives of the emerging church experiments is that they define church as what happens the other 6 days of the week. They don't define church as what happens for an hour on Sunday. And so being church together means for them what you're talking about, living their faith and sharing their faith every day as a part of their life together. And then they gather together to celebrate the church they've been living all these other days. And that's just like taking the traditional model of church and flipping it on its head, and they're doing that very intentionally, and it's really fun to see the life that comes out of that when that's what's animating a community, instead of, all right, kids, get dressed, it's time to go, sit still for an hour.
There's an article about the emerging church in, must be the June issue of the Lutheran.
Yeah, they put Spirit Garage in Minneapolis on the cover.
And they quoted Nadia.
Yeah.
Mercy Seat is another one in the Twin Cities that is quite well known now. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I'm not sure how to ask this. The more is being talked about now, using the word empire, from biblical studies that most of the New Testament is written in relation to the Roman Empire. It speaks to people who live under the empire. And this is also a more so-called secular books too are saying more and more about how we are empire. So one related to that, I read a very, very touching article from Rwanda at a missionary conference. And this was mostly more evangelical, from different missions in Africa. And one of the representatives from Rwanda said to the missionaries, that when you came to Africa, you taught us how to believe in Jesus, but you did not teach us how to live in peace. And what does this mean for the ELCA, or in terms of evangelism? So when we're so hesitant to talk about nonviolence training in the, according to Matthew, turning the other cheek, walking the second mile, Is there something so possibly we might even lose members, you know, that don't want to have the idolatry of empire question in their church? So that, you know, that would be my question. How do we struggle this with, especially in this year of Matthew, when Matthew is so clear in the Beatitudes what it means to follow Jesus and be disciples of Jesus, and yet to really take that seriously could cause us to lose more members and at the same time have a much stronger witness. I don't know what the question is, but it's...
One of the things that I think is the exciting things that I just start to know a little bit about having a church-wide structure is sometimes at least attempting to sing truth to power. You know, right now it's a difficult time because Bishop Hansen cannot speak, George Bush will not speak to Bishop Hansen. He has asked numerous times to speak George Bush will not acknowledge any requests for Bishop Hansen to speak to him. And I think that in itself may be all right.
Good sign.
Yeah. And so I think one of the things, you know, one thing Churchwide does is a social statement. That we all go through, and of course right now we're in the hot one and all that. But what that gives a chance for is for the leaders at Churchwide to speak based on what has been said from the church about those statements. And they do. There's an office in Washington, and many of those statements become more than just from the LCA. They're from, you know, many of the denominations who are able to come together and agree, and it's not always the same group. I know when Ron Young was here talking about his interreligious, where he mentioned that Bishop Hansen was on that, but he was the representative along with the cat, and I don't have the list, but it was Muslim, Jewish, and another Christian. And so I think that's very important, and sometimes that can happen and we don't hear about it that much. I think there is truth being spoken to power at different times, and there's cost to that, and I think it is part of what the church needs to be doing. And I think I think the more people like Dan New who are clear on that can encourage people and challenge, the better. Because I think we're at a time when that may be the role more and more. Don't you think?
Maybe a little off track, but from a local church perspective, I always thought the E in ELCA was an oxymoron. You know, it really doesn't connect with what happens in a lot of local churches. But you know, as we look towards the future and what's happening, it seems a lot of the growth churches are non-liturgical churches. I love our liturgy. I love the new hymnal. But you know, the new hymnal comes out to me speaking of the future of the church. Yet I see very little in the new hymnal that gears towards any type of contemporary services. It doesn't. You know, it's a liturgical hymnal the way we put it out. And we have a lot of churches that, some being very successful in some of their contemporary approaches to service, and some of them just kind of going along, not being successful at all or dropping it off. But I don't know, you know, how the formulation, we hear about the new hymnal coming out for a long time, but I don't hear a lot of church about trying to approach younger people as a whole in the church, other than what happens, you know, individually in communities through individual churches.
One thing I would say that some of those liturgies, how many were at Churchwide this last time? Because some, there's 10 liturgies.
And I've only done about a fourth of them, maybe five.
Because as you get down the line, there's some that are more Central American and what are some?
One's gospel.
And so it kind of depends how it's used. And I think some of the resources that come out will be to try to flesh that out so people know, because at Churchwide it was pretty wild.
And in my own church, for example, we had the we chose the ones that were most similar to what we'd already been doing.
Yeah, there are, I'm not saying that there are some great liturgies in there, and I love the liturgies, but I don't think any, I think a lot of them, yeah, there may be some gospel, there may be ethnicity that comes out in a lot of it, but I don't see anything coming out from the church that's just a contemporary, non-liturgical type approach to service. And I think the majority of, you look at the Pentecostals growing like crazy, the Mormons that are growing, they're non-liturgical approaches that seem to be reaching young people and getting them excited, and our liturgical approach doesn't seem to be. And I, you know, maybe just left field, but I think there's a niche in there that we're somewhat missing.
Aren't there Sundays and seasons?
I think a lot of the churches who, I mean, I guess we've termed them mega churches, which is they don't like, and a lot of them are non-denominational. But my son is a sound engineer at one of the large churches at Calvary Lutheran in Golden Valley. My son is a sound engineer there. Now, they, and being Lutheran, I just thought I'd bring this up, they have their very traditional services in the morning and so forth. They're large enough so they do a lot of recording of weddings, funerals, all their services, and so he has a job. But Sunday afternoons, they have what is called journeys. And I've been hearing this word, journeys, here. And this is the more youth-oriented, and it is contemporary. And I think, and now this is a Lutheran church, and they're using the word journeys, which I've heard out here. And this is a large congregation. Now it's suburban, so there are more young families. We have our churches in the city. But they're bringing them in. And it is a Lutheran ELCA congregation. And it's large enough to be, I mean, they also have apartments and so forth, and, you know, their church has funded. It's a large enough congregation to do this. So he's employed there every Sunday afternoon from like 2 until, I don't know how long this is, but it's called Journeys, and it is definitely a contemporary, so they bring out the drums and the guitars and the praise groups, I think they call them praise groups. And he is a drummer too, but he's not the drummer for that group. He plays the drums in other contemporary services in other churches as a substitute in many service churches that are having contemporary. And those are different denominations, and sometimes they're very small congregations. But anyway,
you know, the other thing is, we had a presentation, we have a new director of music, Bill Beckstrand, and he did a presentation in our congregation on worship. And he talked a lot about what is contemporary. Because like the big Episcopal Cathedral in Seattle packs thousands of young people in totally meditative, right? Is that what it's like?
Yeah. Is it just traditional Compline?
Compline, yeah, but it's very, very, very traditional.
With the choirs.
Not even participatory.
Well, and I think contextually, you know, context is so much. And maybe, I mean, I don't know enough to be a good responder.
Here's a voice from the balcony. I think one of the interesting things about the emerging church movement is that they've discovered that a lot of young people really crave a connection to a tradition that is bigger than just the last 20, 30 years. And that the ancient traditions of the church are actually immensely appealing if offered in a maybe a fresh way, a way that is that tries to connect with people. But it's actually a deep connection to the church's tradition, liturgical tradition. So I think people are discovering that that's
People crave that, actually.
One of the things that cuts across the whole contemporary traditional was done by the natural church development people out of Germany. They looked at 10,000 churches, contemporary services, traditional liturgical services, and found it didn't matter what kind, it mattered on how well it was done. Because they went to just as many contemporary services that were, lack of a better word, lousy. And not, nowhere. And then they went, and the guy who did the study was pro-contemporary music, and he would go into liturgical churches and see the place packed, and he was moved. And he realized it was inspiring. It was done well. And that is the bigger difference, where it's done well with integrity and where it's done just to be done, or not done well at all.
Try to be amazing.
We are at a very interesting time to be a church, I think. Because we are going to have to change a lot. And yet I think we have to hang on to what is it that first of all is Christ for this time. And also what is it in our traditions that you know, can center us in reaching out. And that's a very difficult thing. And I think what Chris was talking about has been talked about a lot at Church Council, the fact that we are very fortunate that we still have the relationship we do with our higher education, our colleges, our seminaries. Many mainline denominations have and no longer have that link. Also our social, all our social
service
network is just the envy of all the other denominations. And we have these overlapping things. And we also have this tradition of the social statements and of the ability to, for our leaders to speak on the basis of those social statements. And so we have some of the things, but then I think what we need to, we have to make these big choices on what do you lean on, and what do you need to be willing to let go. And that it's exciting, but scary. It is. I think a couple statistics I would say is we continue to lose membership. It's not as steep as it was. What's interesting is that mission support is up some in the last year from the individual congregations. And I think there's a mixture of being concerned about all that, but also saying, you know, the point isn't big churches. Yeah. The point is being faithful. The point is figuring out how does Christ's message connect with the needs of the world at this time.
One of the statistics that's really relieving for a lot of Lutherans to hear is based on some recent sociological studies of churches that are growing fast, Pentecostal, whatever, and mainline churches, and it's just birth rates. Mainline demographics are not reproducing at the same rate that Pentecostals are. And so, worship style doesn't explain as much as birth rates. So if Lutherans would just get busy, then we'd have no problem with church growth. And it's true in Europe, too.
I think one place where we can say amen to what we're doing, and that is with the aging. I mean, our retirement homes, our care centers, like the one in Tacoma, is the envy of Pierce County. I mean, we have the condos, we have the apartments, we have the assisted living, we have the care center. And those are through, you can go any place in the country and you'll find a Lutheran retirement center. And I think those, are the envy of all the other denominations. Because, we have all kinds there, and they all just say, you Lutherans do such a good job in your social service and your caring for the aged. And, at that point, I think we can stand up and say, amen.
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 Chris, I thank you for your labor and delivery solution to our problem. But I'd like to go in a different direction.
Go ahead.
When the ELCA started, the wonderful goal of increasing the number of people of color and so forth, it seems to me the recent stuff about Pastor Wright and the church in Chicago highlighted one aspect, at least, of worship among African Americans in one, at least, phase of it. The music style, the style of preaching, the style of living, and so forth. I just don't know, are there encouraging examples of ways in which congregations are successfully coming together with people of quite different backgrounds of life, lifestyle, music, life, and are having good worship, good life together? Is it out there somewhere?
Not in my personal experience. I mean, I've tried to do it as a pastor, and I've longed for it in congregations I've joined as a parishioner, but I've lived in a number of cities that are sort of black cities, and it's really hard to find. And it's really hard to choose. Like we went, the first church we visited when we moved to Atlanta was an all-black congregation. We went there on purpose because we heard really good things about the pastor. And to a person, everyone there thought we were there by accident. You know, they couldn't imagine that we had chosen to come there. And I mean, not every church would be like that, but that experience was. And we looked and that we couldn't find a mixed race church. And in New Haven too, there's one church that's predominantly African American and mostly under the age of 15. I would say 2/3 or 3/4 of the congregation are kids that the pastor brings together, and the other churches are white. And so I think it's a really important goal, but obviously if you look at the statistics, the ELCA has totally failed its optimistic goals when it formed. And I think it's an enormous challenge, and partly it has to do with really serious examination of white privilege and letting go of some of the stuff that we hold on to that keeps that from happening. And I really admire our bishop in New England, Margaret Payne, because she's really pushed hard on our synod to address white racism and white privilege as a precursor to being more serious about building multiracial congregations. So I don't think it's easy to just start with outreach to minority communities. I think we have to start in our own stuff.
One thing I just wanted to say, that one of the books I have with me, and I wish I could remember the author, is in after I'm here, I go to the retreat for the church council, and we have a full book on white privilege and power, and it's really good book. It's very good. Plus handouts and all this that we are going to spend the whole retreat on that issue. So and there's a real commitment that's what the church has to do. That in every layer we have to be addressing that.
I think in the Twin Cities, some of the most successful examples of that are congregations that have gathered together around an immigrant group. Like there's Sudanese who worship together at a Lutheran church, and they are building bridges and partnerships. One of our neighboring congregations has a very large Ethiopian, Eritrean community that worships with them. They worship together, not with them. They worship together. at Trinity Lutheran Church in the Riverside area on the Augsburg College campus. And those have been, I mean, they're still trying to find their way in St. Paul. In the Twin Cities area, that those are some of the examples that I am familiar with that are finding their way. It's difficult, but they're finding their way. Okay, Clara.
Yeah, you know, it has been said, and I agree, it's Sunday morning is the most segregated hour of the week. And, you know, I'm on a committee in my church right now, and strategic vision is the thing we're working with. And we've talked about this issue, and one of my good friends, who's African American, we just sort of both sit there and just say, it's not happening, you know, and it's you want it to happen. And well, at our church, there was a larger number of minority people, some Hispanic and African American, just all of a sudden, for whatever reasons, they moved, you know, job changed, nothing, they didn't get bumped out, but they did, you know. And right now, we've really had a hard time building that back up. It is a goal of ours, but it's not easy. And in St. Louis, remember, there was one black congregation very well-to-do. And so, you know, we go there, and we didn't even feel comfortable because we weren't dressed well enough. You know, it's a strange sort of situation. And even the way they do worship and the way they like that. And I've been to black churches. It's a great experience, you know, it is. They don't feel comfortable with our churches, I don't think.
Hans, and then Kay.
Just a brief comment from our perspective in Portland. We have one church called Maranatha where there is sort of an interracial group. It's not a Lutheran church, but it's known for the fact that it is one of the only places where that takes place. We've had conversations about this, and I think the question to ask also, maybe that's something we want, but do the other cultural groups want it? There was a time when they would have dearly loved to be welcome in our churches. Now there's a certain sense of pride, black pride or whatever, maybe Hispanic pride, that frankly we don't need you whites. We want our own services. So the question is this our need or is this their need? We may be in a stage of not necessarily that's a segregated form of worship, but a transitional stage to what is yet hopefully to be. And maybe we have to have our independence of each other, and that there are some great pioneers who are willing to live out that next stage. And that's a question that I'm asking. What do you think of that concept?
Well, it sounds like what's happening in ELCA are more these like I said, 50% of the new developments are these groups that are, you know, race other than white and language other than English. Mm-hmm. And they, if you look in, you know, the annual book, quite often they are in a church, a church that's already existing.
Right.
So I don't know if that's a stage, if that's...
They share a building, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Like, well, doing that with the Hispanic ministry.
Right.
It's an amazing thing. But they share buildings all over the place.
Yeah. And hopefully more than just share buildings, you know. But
yes.
That's a step, you know.
Very good.
So,
right.
But I think your point is a good one. I mean, we need them.
Yes.
But... I mean, they maybe don't need it. It was one small little thing, is that we have this multicultural ministry task force, and just recently we voted to have an association that is a European American association that's part of that. And people, there was one attorney on church council got very upset. Oh, that sounds like the Ku Klux Klan, and that's it. And then you start thinking, if you don't at that table have a European American, is the ELCA the European American Association? If you're having a multicultural association, you better have a European American association at that table, along with the Hispanic American. American, the Arab American, the China, you know. And that was a big step that Sherman Hicks, who is the, you know, lobbied for, and it was passed. I think it came up at Churchwide, maybe, too.
Could have been.
Yeah. No.
It was a lobby.
But it was, that was one of those mind-twisting things. I mean, I think there's so far we have to go before we're ready to really be truly inclusive.
We do.
Well, it's 9:30, and so...
Anybody wants to come and ask things?
Thank you for coming. The Star Hike starts at 9:45 at the Hike House, if you want to go on a Star Hike tonight. But thank you very much for coming.